I know this is an odd question, but have you ever been thankful that you're not Jesus? I mean, like, despite the obvious and despite Savior complexes and wanting to live as one with God, have you ever just been thankful not to be Jesus? I mean, because sure, there were some people with legitimate hurts and needs coming to him for healing, but there was also a lot of people whining, right? Like, Jesus, tell my sister to come help me in the kitchen. Or like today, Jesus, tell my brother to share the inheritance with me. It's like children. Tell her to stop touching me. Tell him to stop looking at me. I had it first. And, you know, Jesus couldn't just go to the usual responses with these people like, just wait until your father gets home. And so can you imagine the pressure? Because there was also that knowing that no matter how he answered, even if he showed the wisdom of Solomon himself, somebody would be mad. And I think that's what motivated Jesus to start speaking in parables. He could tell these short little stories that shared profound truths with anyone who had the self-awareness to heed them, but would allow the less mature to ignore the meaning or make the story about someone else or all about themselves, depending on which suited their ego needs. I'll talk about this particular story more later, but I want to segue here into this idea of telling stories to teach, stories to admonish, stories to inspire. In her book, The Soul of Money, Lynn Twist uses stories to shine a light on the world economy, on the world and its relationship with money. She tells the story of the history of money, how money is a human invention that humans used in different forms for somewhere over 3,000 years now. How we invented it to help us in sharing and exchanging goods, but we no longer relate to money as a tool that we created and that we control, but rather we've begun to relate to money as a fact of nature, as a force to be reckoned with. We've given money immense power. We've done terrible things in the pursuit of money. We've killed people for it. We've enslaved people for it. We've enslaved ourselves in the joyless pursuit of it. We've exploited entire nations for cheap labor. And we've made a false divide between men and women by granting them different and unequal access to money. Lynn Twist tells the story of her own changing relationship with money and how her first true experience with poverty came in the capital of world hunger, Calcutta, India. She tells us about the heat, the humidity, the press of human flesh, the stink of overburdened sewers, of families of six or more living in makeshift shelters made out of paper and cardboard boxes and string and street trash. And she tells about the beggars, the ever-present beggars, many of whom are part of the industry of begging, because in India, begging is an organized industry, run in many places by mafia-style bosses who encourage people to mutilate their own children so that they will be more effective beggars. For today, I want to share her story about Gertrude and Harlem and skyscrapers and CEOs in Chicago and how money is like water. In 1978, Lynn Twist had just begun work as a fundraiser with the Hunger Project. She was asked by community leaders to do a fundraising event in Harlem, which she wasn't sure was a good idea. She wasn't sure how productive that might be. She also was invited on the very same day to meet with the CEO of a huge food company in Chicago. She decided to do both. Twist started preparing for the Chicago CEO meeting. She worried about what to wear, what to say, how she would be received. When she finally stepped into the elevator in Chicago, she was a jumble of nerves. This was a great big chance. And as the elevator ascended, as it went up and up, she began to sweat and it became hard for her to breathe. She felt this the same as you would if you were climbing a high, high mountain and the air was getting thin and she was way up there and it was hard to breathe. She thought back through what she knew about the CEO and this company. This was as close to a sure thing as it got. This company had recently gotten caught in an ethics scandal and was reeling from the negative press. They felt like making a donation to the Hunger Project, a very public donation, could help clean up their image. Twist was ushered into the CEO's office. She knew she only had 15 minutes. She started to talk, but he shut her down. He didn't care. He handed her a pre-printed check for $50,000. He was ready for her to leave. She took the check, but she couldn't escape the nagging feeling that when that CEO handed her that check, he also handed off a piece of the company's guilt, a bit of their scandal, a portion of their we couldn't care less. Twist flew to New York, made her way through a rainstorm to an old church building in Harlem, descended the steps to the basement where about 75 people were sitting in folding chairs. Placed all around the outer walls were buckets collecting the dirty rainwater that seeped down from the streets above. She told her story, who she was, what the Hunger Project was. She felt awkward about it, but from these people, obviously not wealthy people, she asked for money. After a long silence, one woman stood up. Late 60s, early 70s, gray hair in a neat bun, tall, erect, proud. "Girl," she said, "my name is Gertrude. I like what you've said, and I like you. Now, I've got no checkbook or credit cards. To me, money is like water. For some folks, it rushes through their life like a raging river. Money comes through my life like a little trickle. But I want to pass it on in a way that does the most good for the most folks. I see that as my right and my responsibility. And it's also my joy. I have $50 in my purse that I earned from doing other people's laundry. I want to give it to you." She walked up and handed Lynn Twist $50 in fives, tens, and ones. She gave her a big hug, and then other people started coming forward. They started making their own contributions of ones and fives and tens until Twist couldn't hold all the money, so she opened up her briefcase and set it on the table in front of her, watched as those ones and fives and tens covered over that envelope with its $50,000 check inside. Started crying, left grateful, mailed the $50,000 check back to the CEO the next morning, kept the $500. "Money is like water," Gertrude said. "For some folks, it rushes through their life like a raging river. Money comes through my life like a little trickle, but I want to pass it on in a way that does the most good for the most folks. I see that as my right and my responsibility. It is also my joy." Money is like water. When it's moving, it carries along the energy of our commitment, the stamp of our very souls. When money flows from us, it carries a bit of our spirit, or our guilt, or our indifference. What if the man in Jesus's parable had realized this about wealth, that it's not the amount of our wealth that's important, that how much we have or how much we can buy with it is nothing compared to the power our money has for good in the world. What if he had understood the power money has like a roaring river when it carries purpose, intention, soulful energy, joy, and gratitude with it? I think we should sort out a few of the details of this story, though, about this rich farmer before we get too far into it. You know, it begins with a voice from the crowd. It could be anybody. It might have been several people saying to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Now, in the first century, there were rules about dividing inheritance. We think of these inheritance laws as archaic, unenlightened, but they may not be so very. Anyway, different sects interpreted the rules of inheritance differently. For some, the oldest son inherited everything. No debate, no probate lawyers. Some gave 2/3 or even 3/4 of an existing estate to the oldest son and the remaining 1/3 or 1/4 to the next oldest. Nothing to the daughters. We can't be sure what that voice from the crowd was asking. Was he asking that Jesus, as moral authority, demand an older brother divide an inheritance that was not required to be divided? Was this voice asking Jesus to demand that an older brother stop holding on to the entire inheritance and divide it rightfully with his younger brother? Was the owner of this disembodied voice greedy at all? Had he been working in the family business all his life and now was going to lose his livelihood and be unable to provide for wife and children? We don't know. Here's what we do know. On this day, Jesus was not interested in taking up the topic as it was presented. You know, it might have been a great opportunity for him to talk about all those justice issues he was always bringing up. Something like, the first will be last and the last will be first, or go and sell all that you have and give it to the poor. But no, Jesus decided to take another tact on this discussion. He's not concerned about debating the religious laws. He has something else to say. The land of a rich farmer produced abundantly, and the farmer thought, "What should I do? For I have no place to store my crops." Then the farmer said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain." That farmer did not realize that money is like water, that it comes into your life in a trickle or a steady stream or a waterfall, windfall. That like water, money collected, held, stagnant, loses its life-giving properties, becomes dirty, useless, even deadly sometimes. We should take heed lest we become more like this farmer than like Gertrude. The farmer is not grateful. The text clearly states that the land produced abundantly, as though this abundance wasn't the result of the farmer's work at all. It was the result of sun and rain and good soil. This farmer is blessed, but doesn't even realize it. And this farmer is greedy. Don't you see that with him, no amount of wealth would ever be enough? He didn't put away a little for a rainy day. His first thought is not to build more barns to store up his crops. "No, I will pull down my barns and build bigger ones," he said. He's completely bought into the myth of money. "I need more, 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 so that it can sit stagnant and build interest, not build community. Not ease hunger, not build up hope, but build more wealth. And this farmer is afraid. He's going to store up all that grain. You can forgive him for that, right? Because we never know when flood or drought or insects will strike, right? And just because God has always provided before doesn't ensure that God will provide again, right? We must be prepared for the feast and the famine. But if only that farmer was more like Gertrude. What I've got, I'm not going to hoard. What I've got, I'm going to give. So what if all of us here today decided to start living like money was water? In the book of Revelation, we read, "Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations." What if we lent our money, our wealth, our goods to the river of the water of life that waters the tree of life, whose leaves are for the healing of the nation? Lynn Twist works for the Hunger Project. The Hunger Project is an organization with programs in 16,000 communities throughout Africa, South Asia, and Latin America. Their programs are based on an innovative, holistic approach which empowers women and men, especially women living in rural villages, to become the agents of their own development, to become the authors of their own progress in overcoming hunger and poverty. The Hunger Project doesn't offer charity. It offers solutions, investment, inspiration. The Hunger Project claims that we have the resources right now to end hunger within 50 years. Now, I'm not going to give you the numbers on hunger. The numbers will discourage you. But we are making progress. I won't even suggest what you should do. Sustainable solutions, sustainable behaviors come from our own decisions, not from any kind of coercion. I need you to investigate this issue for yourself, to find your place in the water of life. Wendell Berry wrote in The Long-Legged House, "We have lived our lives by the assumption that what was good for us would be good for the world. We have been wrong. We must change our lives so that it will be possible to live by the contrary assumption that what is good for the world will be good for us. And that requires that we make the effort to know the world and to learn what is good for it." Amen.